All right. Well, it was fun hearing about the latest findings on Mars, and there's actually an argument there for the Christian faith in this sense. We're the only species on planet Earth that cares what Mars is all about, right? We're the only species that cares about fundamental particles. And the thing about we human beings, we're compulsively curious. In fact, we're curious to a point where we'll even sacrifice our own well-being to satisfy our curiosity. I mean, look at the risks we take just to try to satisfy our curiosity. And how do you explain this from a naturalistic perspective? It makes no sense if it's just simply natural selection and survival of the fittest, that we would actually sacrifice our own physical well-being in order to learn these kinds of things. Well, I've been gone for a couple of weeks. It's good to be back. I'm glad I'm going to be with you throughout all of December. I am going to be doing some travel, but it's going to be between Sundays, so I will be here every Sunday. But while I've been gone, there's been a remarkable discovery that I think gives us a substantial new argument for the Christian faith. I'm actually developing a talk on it. So what I thought I would do this morning is kind of give you an outline of a talk I'm developing. And it's actually going to be going into a future book as well. And I just appreciate feedback that you might have. So if you got questions or suggestions about how this could be improved. But the theme is how blessed we are that we've had really big extraterrestrial collision events in recent history. And it's remarkable that the time we live in, that we've had such dramatic extraterrestrial collision events, but every one of them is making possible billions of human beings living here at one time with the technology where we can hear the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ and spread it to all the people groups of the world. I'm beginning with this slide right here. I'm supposed to point this way. And probably I need to drop this down so that doesn't get in the way of the camera. And if you're new here to the class, we do live stream to the virtual world. And I just found out that there are two apologetics organizations that actually post the video of this class every week. And literally thousands are viewing the classes. So watch your behavior here. But I say that for one reason. Is that a comment I get from people who participate with us through the live streaming or through the downloads is sometimes they have a hard time hearing the questions you ask. We do have microphones here to try to pick up your questions, but yeah, try to speak loudly. And if for some reason it is soft, someone here remind me and I'll repeat the question. So that's just a comment we got from our people who do participate through the technology of the internet. But what you see here is the second largest iron meteorite that's ever been recovered. This is sitting in the Danish National History Museum in Copenhagen. You say, well, where's the biggest one? It's in the Smithsonian at Washington. But it was recovered from the same location this was recovered from. There's a site in northwestern Greenland. And this is a remnant of what's called the Cape York meteorite. A big meteorite struck in North Greenland, and they've recovered eight pieces that are bigger than 100 pounds. This one comes in at 22 tons. So, but there's actually one bigger. This one is 33 tons, but there's one that's 39 tons that sits in the Smithsonian. So, and a few weeks ago, yes?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, I hope they can hear me. How big a crater did that thing make when it hit? Did it hit land? I assume it hit land, right?
Okay, you're gonna have to wait because they've not found the crater until 10 days ago.
Okay.
So, this is kind of what's going on. Yeah, I'll get to that. Okay, but a few weeks ago, I was sharing with you the discovery of a major crater event that's off the south tip of Chile, and this is what's called the El Tananin Impactor, and only recently have they discovered the crater site. It's 35 kilometers in diameter. The debris of the asteroid that hit there is spread over 500 square kilometers. They only found it recently. Why? Because it's below 5,000 feet of ocean. So it's difficult to find craters that are that deep underground.
However,
they've been able to date it. And what's interesting is that the date corresponds with the date of the onset of the ice age cycle that we're enjoying right now. You know, for the last 2.588 million years, we've been in an ice age cycle. The first time in the entire history of the Earth, we've been in an ice age cycle. There have been ice ages before, but they've not been cyclical. This is the only time where we got a cyclical one. And I wrote a book called Improbable Planet, is over there, chapter 15, on why we have to be in an ice age cycle in order for human civilization to thrive. And the cycle is that we go from about 10% coverage with ice of our planet to about 20 to 23%. And right now we're in what's called an interglacial, which means you only have 10% of our planet covered with ice. But the cycle operates in the way that you have about 90,000 year period where you got 20 to 23% coverage with ice, and then you get a 10,000 year period where you only have 10%. But in order for human civilization to thrive, we have to have the melting of glaciers left over from the last ice age to produce the great rivers that water our agricultural plains. So, for example, the Missouri River is fed by glaciers in the Rockies that enable us to grow a large quantity of food. And if you look in Southeast Asia, they got 20 major rivers that flow out of the ice fields of the Himalayas and the Tibetan Plateau that make it possible to grow enough food to feed 3 billion human beings. So we're in an ice age cycle, but what they've now recognized is that this asteroid, and you say, how big was the asteroid? 1 to 4 kilometers across. So this is a giant asteroid that struck there and struck with such force. And given that it hit in the ocean there, it basically created these water vapor aerosols all over the Earth. And that cooled the planet down because it reflected away sunlight. It cooled the planet down. And in combination with 5 simultaneous major tectonic events, that cooled the planet sufficiently that ice could form. Before the ice age cycle, we had no ice on planet Earth at all. And for 90% of Earth's history, there's no ice. And the sun gets brighter and brighter as it gets older and older. So the miracle is that we've got ice today when the sun is so very bright. But it was this event, and in combination with 5 unprecedented tectonic events, ignited the ice age. But the ice age cycle that it ignited had a 41,000 year period. You say, why? Because of the tilt of our rotation axis. Our rotation axis right now is 23.5 degrees, but it tilts back and forth between 24.1 and 22.5. And as it tilts over to 24 degrees, that warms the planet. As it goes back to 22.5, that cools the planet. That is a 41,000 year cycle. But that's not appropriate for human civilization because the interglacial, in that case, is less than 2,000 years wide. And 2,000 years is not enough time to sustain the kind of civilization we have today. But it was a second collision event that changed the cycle from 41,000 years to the 100,000 years we have today. And once again, this crater site was very difficult to find, because it happened in the South China Sea. And basically, it created the Spratly Islands. Well, actually, we had big islands there. And then you had this asteroid hitting in that area. And it basically reduced them to these just these little tiny atolls that are there in the center of the South China Sea. But it hit at an angle that threw up a huge quantity of dust that escaped the gravity of planet Earth, and every 100,000 years we pass through that dust cloud, and that has the impact of cooling down the planet. And so for the last 800,000 years, we've had an ice age cycle that looks like this. And what you notice is that you have a long period where you got 20 to 23% of the surface of the Earth covered. And incidentally, you're living on the continent that has the most dramatic experience of the ice age cycle. Because when we're in an ice age, 55% of North America is covered with 1,000 feet of ice or more. And for example, during the last ice age, we had ice come all the way down into Southern California. So the most southward impact of the last ice age cycle was right here in the state of California. Yes?
Is that dust cloud related to a meteor shower?
It's basically dust. I mean, there's lots of meteor showers, and none of the major meteor showers are associated with this. Meteor showers are annual events. This is a cloud of dust that the Earth passes through about once every 100,000 years. So they don't give it the term meteor shower, because that's usually reserved for something that happens annually. Or in the case of one, there's one that happens every 33 years. The November 17th meteor shower, that happens every year, but every 33 years it's especially intense. But this is distinct from that. And I wrote three blog articles on how we get this transition from a 41,000-year cycle to a 100,000-year cycle. And what you'll see in those three blog articles, this collision event in the Spratly Islands is only one of several things that must take place to change it from 41,000 years to approximately 100,000. In fact, there's over a dozen different natural events all happening at the same time that give us what we see here over the past 400,000 years. Yeah, question.
How long ago did that happen?
The Spratly Island event, 800,000 years ago. So, and 800,000 years ago is when the cycle shifted from 41,000 years to 100,000 years. You know, that's what's called the mid-Pleistocene transition, where the ice age cycle now becomes 2.5 times longer than it was before. But that's important for human civilization, because for human civilization to develop to the level that we have today, you need a minimum of 12,000 years of a warm interglacial, not just 2,000 years.
Because I read a description of the solar system and the universe in total as a shooting gallery, where everything's going around hanging to another planet. Is that a map description of the universe?
Well, it's a mild shooting gallery. We only have 5 small asteroid and comet belts. What we've now learned in looking at other planetary systems is that the vast majority have no asteroids and no comets at all. And that's because their gas giant planets have migrated in too close to the host stars. And if they migrate in too close, it basically blows out all the asteroids and comets. The second category are where the gas giant planets don't migrate at all. If they don't migrate at all, you get asteroid and comet belts that are about 1,000 times bigger than the ones in our solar system. And that would be the typical shooting gallery. What has happened in our planetary system, and it's the only planetary system where we've observed this to happen, is that the gas giant planets migrated in towards the sun, stopped, and changed direction and moved back out. And because of that, we have 5 tiny asteroid and comet belts. And so we get a mild shooting gallery rather than the typical shooting gallery. I mean, if you look at the typical shooting gallery, these things will be happening so frequently that there's no possibility for advanced life at all. I mean, you don't want a 1 kilometer asteroid hitting the planet Earth on a weekly basis. That would not be good for our general well-being. Because, for example, when these things hit, it has a global impact. An asteroid that's a kilometer in diameter or bigger, when it hits, it'll throw up so much debris and dust in the atmosphere, you get what's called a nuclear-type winter. You know, basically, it cools the whole climate down for years on end and has a devastating impact on all advanced life. And so, but 2.588 million years ago, there were no human beings around. 800,000 years ago, there weren't any human beings around. So there wasn't any civilization to disturb. So, but because of that event, those two collision events, we get an ice age cycle, which we need in order to be able to feed billions of people. And as I've reminded you before, not only do you get water from the melting of the glaciers left over from the last ice age, every time you get a new cycle, you get a refertilization of the great agricultural plains. Because as the ice recedes from the 20 to 23%, you get a powerful wind that takes dust off the high plateaus and fertilizes all the great agricultural plains. So you need both in order to have a large population. You can read the book. There's another 10 benefits we get from the ice age cycle. But to really have human civilization, you want a 100,000-year cycle, not a 41,000-year cycle. And this shows the last four cycles. But what you notice is our cycle is different from the previous cycles. What you notice is that this is a record of the global mean temperature with respect to time. And what you see is that the global mean temperature spikes up to about 2 to 3 degrees centigrade above where it is now, and then rapidly drops back down into an ice age, which persists for about 90,000 years. Then the same thing happens again, where it spikes up. But notice, the one we're in right now, it didn't spike up. It stopped short of going up to 2 to 3 degrees centigrade above where we are right now. And they've just discovered 10 days ago the reason why we stopped short. And also the reason why we transitioned from this incredibly extreme climate instability. This shows you the last ice age before we went into an interglacial. And what you notice here is that the global mean temperature jumps up and down by 16 degrees centigrade. And you can convert that into Fahrenheit. That's about 27 degrees Fahrenheit. Jumps up and down by that much on time scales of a few centuries or less. And with a climate that unstable, you can't sustain any kind of sophisticated, large-scale civilization. As I mentioned before here in the class, we now have evidence that humans living during this period were engaged in sophisticated technology, but at a very low level, very small-scale level. The evidence they've uncovered is that they were actually planting fields of grain, harvesting the grain, roasting the grain, grinding the grain, and turning it into bakery products. I mean, that's relatively sophisticated activity. However, how long ago? They found it 14,000 years ago, 23,000 years ago, and 35,000 years ago. So evidently, humans throughout this period were engaged. We may discover more evidence. That's the evidence that's been discovered so far. But what they found is, in every case, very small scale. Very small scale because the climate was so unstable, there is no way to scale it up. In fact, not until the climate stabilized do you see people growing large farms where they specialize. So what was going on during this period is that people would, say, have 1 or 2 acres. They would plant a dozen or 15 different food crops. Because of the climate instability, 10 or 12 would fail. They would feed their family and what remains. And so everything had to be small scale and highly diversified because of how the climate was so unstable. But this is what happened beginning 9,000 years ago, is that the climate stabilized. And this is the only time in the entire ice age cycle where you got climate stability. And because we've had 9,000 years,
where the climate, global mean temperature, has not varied by more than 2.5 degrees centigrade, it's been possible for us to launch and sustain civilization and actually multiply our population up into the billions. Now, what is new, recently published, is that this temperature you see here is based on Greenland ice cores. And this temperature that you see here, in terms of the last 9,000 years of climate stability, they did not correct for the altitude effect. Okay, as you all know, if you go up into high altitude, the temperature tends to be more unstable than it is at sea level. Any of us who climb the mountains here in California will have experienced that. The ice cores, where they kind of drill down and look at hundreds of thousands of years of layers of ice and therefore able to measure what the temperature was back thousands of years ago, the ice cores in Greenland are all at high altitude. Most of Greenland is like 8,000 feet above sea level, and you got thousands of feet of ice on top of that. So what has happened is a group of research scientists basically said, what we're going to do is look at not just Greenland, but sites on all the continents. They actually looked at 73 different places where they could get reliable proxies for the past temperature of the Earth. And then they also weighted them as to which ones they thought were the most reliable compared to the ones that were less reliable. And they corrected for the altitude effect and basically have produced a new measure of the global mean temperature over the past 12,000 years. And this is what they have published. This is what it looks like. Now, I've expanded the temperature resolution. You notice I'm giving you the temperature resolution here in 0.2 degrees centigrade. What they have concluded is that the global mean temperature over the past 9,000 years is twice as stable as what we thought just a year ago, which means all of us here are twice as blessed as what we thought we were a year ago. That we actually have a global mean temperature or a climate stability that's far more extreme than what we presumed before. So we knew we were blessed. Here we have this 2.6 million year period of ice age cycle, and we just happen to be living in the only time where instead of having extreme climate instability, we got extreme climate stability. And it's also at the optimal temperature for launching and sustaining human civilization. So the question is this a coincidence, or is this part of the blessing of our Creator in generating this period of extreme climate stability? But I also want you to notice what you see over the past 9,000 years is a gradual cooling of the global mean temperature. And we now understand why. 8,800 years ago is when the tilt of our rotation axis was at its maximum of 24.5 degrees. And so that's when you would get the greatest heat as a result of that varying tilt. And so as the tilt has gone from 23.5 degrees down to about 23.5 where it is now, we see that the global mean temperature has been getting cooler and cooler in a way that you would predict. However, with one exception, you would expect that the changing tilt of our rotation axis would give us a far more dramatic cooling effect than we see here. It's just a gradual cooling. I mean, if I were to go back to what we see here, notice when it hits a peak, you don't get a gradual cooling, you get a very dramatic cooling that drops us quickly into an ice age. Instead, what we have is just a very slow cooling effect, but we can attribute it to the fact that the tilt of our rotation axis is declining from its maximum. So going back to here, and what I want to show you, and this is a graph that we've developed at Reasons to Believe, is to take this new demonstration. And incidentally, what I have put at the very end, I added a line. Do you see that blue line at the very beginning? Yeah. So it basically represents that in the last 50 years, all that cooling that took place over 8,800 years has been completely reversed in the last 50 years. So the temperature has actually jumped above the maximum of where it was 8,800 years ago. All that's happened in the past 50 years. So when people talk about global warming, it's real. The temperatures around the world actually confirm that, yeah, there's been this sudden jump in temperature in the, just the past 50 years. What I want to show you in the next graph is something we produced at Reasons to Believe, which basically takes this period of extreme climate stability, and we look at it in the context of what has happened in the 7,000 years that are previous. And so this is what it looks like. So you see this period of extreme climate stability for the past 9,500 years. But previous to that, we see the typical dramatic temperature variations. But what I want to point out to you is something that we call the Younger Dryas event. And I don't know if you can see the dotted lines here or not, but what you see is there's this little window here where you got the temperature dropping dramatically, and it stays low for about 1,200 years, then it jumps back up very suddenly. Yes?
Was that variation dramatic enough for the average person living during that period would notice that every year it was just wildly different, or it's not within the...
Well, this corresponds to what's called the Clovis disaster. If you're aware, they have all these paleoanthropology sites here in North America called the Clovis sites. And this is where the first humans that had settled here in North America were establishing villages, having these tiny farms, and doing a lot of hunting. And there are about 50 of those sites throughout North America. But what they've noticed is that when you have this Younger Dryas event, where the temperature basically drops suddenly by 15 degrees centigrade, that it has two effects. It basically knocks out the Clovis culture. It's devastated by this event. And also you see a megafaunal extinction, that the large mammals here in North America are either wiped out or almost entirely wiped out. So this is when, for example, the mastodons, the woolly mammoths, were devastated by this cold event, and not just them, but many other large mammals as well. And there's been a big debate. Is it this extreme cold event called the Younger Dryas that was responsible for wiping out these large mammals here on planet Earth? There are sloths here, there are horses here, camels, and these mammoths, or was it the hunting of the Clovis individuals? The consensus now, it's a combination of the two, that these Clovis humans were getting desperate for food as a result of this extreme cold event, and therefore they overhunted some of these large animals. So anyway, what's been happening in the scientific literature is trying to come up with an explanation for this Younger Dryas event. It's the most dramatic event we see in the Ice Age cycle, in the sense that instead of the temperature going up and down like this, it suddenly drops, and it drops by an enormous degree, stays really cold, and then notice how suddenly it warms back up. And this is during a period when you would expect the climate to warm. If I could go back to this particular graph here, you've got this event happening. This is it right here. This is a time when you would expect the temperature to steadily rise to a maximum. So it steadily rises, drops down, then goes back up. And so this is unique, because you know, if you go back to here, you see that you've got a steady rise in all those cases. So this is a dramatic interruption of the rise of the global mean temperature, and the longest lasting and the most dramatic. And so this has been a study for the past two decades. What's responsible for this Younger Dryas event? Well, the theory that's been most popular, yes.
Eventually, of course, we'll all that have anything to do with this warming?
Yeah, it doesn't have anything to do with this, because you are right, we are going to move outside of the habitable zone for our sun. That's because the sun, like all stars, when it's converting hydrogen into helium, it gets brighter and brighter as it gets older and older. And as the sun gets brighter and brighter, it's going to push us outside of that habitable zone. And if you're interested in how quickly that's going to happen, well, it takes humanity out of the zone first. So we'll be the first to disappear as a result of the sun getting brighter. The last to go will be the bacteria. And you say, well, when's the doomsday date for humanity as a result of the brightening of the sun? It's about 10 million years into the future. However, a lot less than 10 million years will be the end of civilization as we know it. When I say we won't disappear until 10 million years, that means that near the end of that 10 million years, we'll be reduced to a Stone Age technology with a low population. That's how we're going to have to be able to survive the increasing temperature. But we're talking about something that's in the order of thousands of years, not millions of years. So this is distinct from that. But yeah, the most popular, there was another hand over here, yes.
Okay, so I see this period of stability you're talking about for roughly 10,000 years, right? Am I reading the
graph? Yeah, you're reading the graph correctly.
Okay, so there's something that's bothered me for a long time, because we think that Homo sapiens have existed for like maybe 50,000 to 100,000 years. But yet the writing seems to only have been within a 10,000 year window. Do you think this has contributed to the fact that early man didn't write down as much and have a developed written language, or am I, there's other factors probably, but what do you think?
Maybe you're onto something. I mean, for example, when you're in this kind of a situation, trying to launch a written language is well nigh impossible because of the extreme climate instability. When the climate is this unstable, as you see here in this chart, you're basically having to devote 98% or more of the population to coming up with enough food to feed everybody. That means you don't have the luxury of setting aside very many individuals to engage in non-agricultural activities. So the whole idea of having a segment of the population focus on doing mathematics and literature simply is not an option.
Yeah, they're worried about rotating their crops and just surviving. Right?
They're worried about surviving. But once you've got this climate stability, now it's possible to specialize, scale up your agriculture, and produce a surplus of food, where it's now possible to set aside a large fraction of your population that can do engineering, science, literature, art, music, mathematics, etc. And this is really what launches civilization at the pace that we've observed over the past 10,000 years. You've probably heard of something called the Neolithic Revolution. That's when humanity, for the first time, begins to build villages and set up transportation systems and begin to specialize in the manufacture of pottery. It's the first time you've got villages where all they do is manufacture pottery. Or make tools. In other villages, all they do is grow wheat, or they do nothing but raise domesticated animals. That requires climate stability to be able to. But the thing that's interesting, the moment we got the climate stability that makes that possible, immediately you have it. There's no delay. So it basically shows just how powerfully motivated we human beings are to invent and, innovate and launch technology. Again, kind of the argument we made at the very beginning of the class here. We human beings are curious to a degree that can't be explained by a naturalistic worldview perspective. I mean, we're curious to a degree where it actually hinders our capability of surviving in a Stone Age technology, but we've been given that anyway. Well, it's not just our intellect. I mean, look how we focus our intellect. We actually target our intellect to learn things that really have no benefit for our survival. I mean, for example, I remember when I was in my early years, I mean, like 7, 8, 9 years of age, my friends were saying, hey, you're pursuing astronomy. How is that going to benefit the world economy? If you're learning about galaxies that are hundreds of millions and billions of light years away, that can't possibly have any benefit. Where are you going to get a job? So, but the reason why I got a job in astronomy is that humanity is curious about those stars and galaxies, whether or not it puts any extra money in your wallet. And so, in fact, we support missions to Mars, even though the likelihood that it's going to benefit your pocketbook 10 or 20 years from now, matter of fact, it costs you money, right? Look at your tax bill that you have to pay. And so, but the whole point is, if you're to survey the American population, should we learn more about the moon and Mars and the stars and galaxies? They would say yes. And even though it's going to, take some money to make that happen, we do that. So that's just part of it. But I mean, your point is well taken there too, is that, in terms of a written language, it takes this period of extreme climate stability to make that possible. Yes.
You are trying at this point to try to fit Garden of Eden out of this time, and particularly the time of the flood. Since you mentioned that the extreme temperature changes, you saw that there's sites in North America where we see this. So how far are you pushing back?
How far are we pushing back Adam and Eve?
And the flood.
And the flood. I would say both of these events are happening in this period. Now, I believe that what you see in Genesis chapter 2 puts the location of the Garden of Eden in what is now 250 feet below sea level in the southeast portion of the Persian Gulf. And so that would put it during the last ice age. The fact that it took 7.5 months for the flood waters of Noah to recede, again means it has to be a time when there'd be sufficient ice melt on the mountains around that region to keep the waters flowing for that period of time. And so that too would be an ice age event. Now, it says, well, why would God create Adam and Eve then and not when we got this period of extreme climate stability? He had theological reasons for doing it as early as he did. Notice we have this period where people lived for 800 or 900 years, at least had the potential to live 800 or 900 years. I've taught here in the class that part of that is an object lesson, that the lifespan we have right now is really the optimal lifespan. To live only 20 years would be a problem, especially since it takes us 25 years to grow up, right? And these days we wonder if even that's enough time to grow up. So it's just to physically, like a man is not physically mature until he's 25. And so you don't want to be dying too long. But the point is, if you let people live too long, that means people like Joe Stalin, Adolf Hitler, and Mao Zedong wouldn't be just killing 10 or 20 million people each. They'd be killing hundreds of millions. In fact, the story, what we see before the flood, is that because people have the potential to live so long, the wicked were killing off the righteous to a degree that only one righteous family was left. And so God shortened the lifespan as a blessing to humanity. And you say, well, why didn't God do that right off the bat? How many of you believe it is really good to die young? That's a hard thing to persuade people, that it's to your advantage to die young rather than to live a lot of years. We consider it blessed when somebody actually lives a few decades longer. And I would argue that is a blessing. But I think this is an object lesson that God teaches. Now, don't get me wrong. I think there's a lot more going on in the early chapters of Genesis and the early history of humanity than just that object lesson. And moreover, if you're living in the Persian Gulf area, you're at, as I mentioned before, the lower your elevation, the more stable your climate is, just because of the air pressure is higher, and the humidity typically is higher. And so like the climate at the bottom of the Dead Sea is a lot more stable than it is on top of Mount Everest. And so the Persian Gulf being 250 feet below sea level during the last ice age, it was 330 feet. That's how low the sea level was. that would give you, and it's towards the tropics, and you're towards the mouth of the Indian Ocean, that would probably be the most stable place to put humanity at that time. So the Garden of Eden was, the location makes sense in the context of living during this period. Anyway, advancing forward, now we got this period of extreme climate stability, and we really like this chart because it really shows you how extremely stable our climate has been over the past 9,500 years compared to what has been typical throughout the rest of the Ice Age cycle. So look at the temperature jumping up and down before that period and see how stable it is right now. You got a question here? Yeah.
I've been trying to figure out why is some of it in blue ink and some of it in red?
Because I designed this graph.
well, the same thing happens on your ice cycles. I thought that, well, maybe the red is when the temperature's increasing and the blue is when the...
No. But this is just me saving time. What I did is I took material from research papers, and they had their data plotted in blue. I took it from another research paper where they had it in this purple color. And rather than trying to waste a lot of time getting the colors to be equal, I just put the two together. So this is a graph that I constructed. But it does show the reality of what the temperature was like over the past 17,000 years. Yes?
What's the significance of the present temperature being minus 30
C? Oh, okay. Again, I took data that represents what was going on in Greenland at that time. So I could correct the temperature for the global mean temperature, but I didn't do that. I thought it'd be more faithful to actually, use the temperature records as they're displayed at that particular location. So that's why I put air temperature there. It's not the same as a global mean temperature.
Is that representative of global temperatures then? It's just scaled differently?
Pardon me?
Is that representative of global?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, I could change the numbers on the side and you would be the same. But again, I was just wanting to make sure that, when people look at this, they would realize I haven't been fudging things. I'm actually using the actual data in the published papers. Yes, and then there's a hand over here. Yeah.
Dr. Ross, is there any scientists nailed down when the Garden of Eden happened?
Okay, in terms of a scientific date for the Garden of Eden, what we see in Genesis 2 is a time when four rivers that are known rivers come together in the Garden of Eden. The only place they come together is in the southeastern portion of the Persian Gulf. So it pins a location down, but since that location today is 250 feet below sea level, we know it can't be in the last 10,000 years. It's got to be earlier than that. So sometime during the last ice age, I wrote about this in Navigating Genesis, also making the point that there are three times during the last ice age where you got an easy migration route up going following the Gihon River into East Africa. And I argue that's significant because the earliest finds we have for human beings is in two locations, the Persian Gulf and East Africa. So that makes sense that the Garden of Eden event was probably at a time when humans could easily migrate from the Persian Gulf into East Africa. Today, for example, that migration route is so difficult that you have to have a specialized jeep to be able to do it because there's this enormous sand desert that covers the southern Arabian. But there are actually three times during the last ice age where there was a plentiful food supply and an easy migration route along the Gihon River that would take you right into East Africa, because during the last ice age, a large part of the Red Sea was also dry. So it was actually a land bridge joining Arabia to East Africa. So that gives you a little bit of a pin down, but it's still not all that accurate. Well, that's true. The settlement of North America was much later, but we got dates that are going back 50,000 years into Western Asia and into Africa. And so those dates are earlier than the dates for the human settlement of, I mean, you see this in Genesis 10, where God scatters humanity throughout the face of the earth. And this is where you see humans migrating into Australia and North and South America. But those dates are later than the dates for the first evidence for the existence of human beings.
That would be after the Tower of Babel, right?
Yeah, the Tower of Babel instance is where you actually see humanity becoming global. And North America is one of the last settled places.
But that would, you would have thought the Garden of Eden would have been somewhere else instead of the Middle East.
Well, the Middle East makes sense in the sense that's where you're going to have the greatest climate stability. We read in the text that Adam and Eve began without wearing clothes. So you want to be a place that's warm enough where that's possible. So the Garden of Eden you don't want to have in Alaska. So, and then the fact that we have the earliest finds in both the Persian Gulf area and East Africa. So that, that's all consistent with the biblical location. And then the fact that we see later dates for the settlement of Australia, North and South America. Over here. Right, it's the place that had the richest resources. So, and John, you had a comment?
Yes, regarding the Persian Gulf, I've read of reports where there are subsurface structural ruins about 100 feet below the current level. So, in later times, there was human occupation of that area before the sea continued to rise.
Well, that's what's interesting. I think I've written about this in Navigating Genesis as well, is that the earliest village evidence we have is on the shore of the Persian Gulf. And what's interesting is that you find later villages at higher levels. So it's basically evidence that human beings were moving up to higher and higher elevations. And during the last ice age, you got the Persian Gulf filling up. And so the German archaeologists who discovered these 60 villages that rank as the oldest villages that are known basically concluded his research paper saying there must be villages that would be below the current surface of the Persian Gulf because we see evidence of humans moving to higher and higher land. And so he actually said maybe we should send scuba divers down to see if we can find villages at significant depths in the Persian Gulf. But he's not a believer, and what he ended his paper with saying, if there's any credence to the Genesis flood story, it's going to be a waste of time for us to look for those villages because that flood would have destroyed them. So that's kind of where the paper ended, but quite interesting. Now, hey, time is running away from me, so let me see if I can push on here. Okay, in terms of explaining this Younger Dryas event, the most popular explanation for the past 20 years has been that it was a breach of Lake Agassiz. So this takes you back during the last ice age, and this is a time when ice still covers all of Quebec, covers all of the Hudson's Bay area, and covers Keewatin, Northwest Territories, Baffin Island, and there's actually ice that goes all the way to Greenland. So we still have a large chunk of North America covered with ice. That lake that you see there that I put on that map, it's basically a lake of glacial meltwater. So the glaciers, the ice fields are receding, and it creates this massive lake. And today, that's the lakes that you see over Minnesota and Manitoba and parts of Saskatchewan and Ontario. But the thinking was that this Lake Agassiz, they know, during the last ice age, drained down the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico. But what they notice is that we see a change in that drainage from the Mississippi up the St. Lawrence. And basically what they're claiming is that there was some event that happened 11,900 years ago, 12,900 years ago, where Lake Agassiz got breached, where there was a blockage from the flow down to Mississippi, and it opened up a channel to flow out the St. Lawrence River, and that caused a rush of cold water to go into the North Atlantic, and that rush of cold, fresh water stopped the Gulf Stream. And with the stopping of the Gulf Stream, basically turned back the Gulf Stream. And evidence in support of that, they now have been able to determine, at that time, the tropical Atlantic got warmer. Why? Because instead of all that warm water going up to Norway, it got turned around and went back to the tropics. So here we have this global cooling event, but we got the tropical Atlantic getting warmer. That all makes sense if we got a rush of cold, fresh water pouring out from Lake Agassiz into the North Atlantic, and explains why the continental land masses around the world experience this 1,200-year cold event known as the Younger Dryas. Now, they've actually been able to make measurements at the mouth of the St. Lawrence that indicates that indeed there is a massive flow of cold glacial meltwater that poured out at the beginning of what's called the Younger Dryas. So yeah, we have evidence for that. What is not known is what caused the breach. Well, what happened back in 2013, a paper got published where they went to all these Clovis sites in North America, and what they found was carbon, charcoal, soot. They found microspherules. They found glass, little glass spheres. And they also found an iridium signature. This is all what you'd expect if there is an extraterrestrial collision event. So they basically were saying, we think what caused the breach of Lake Agassiz was some big crater or big meteorite event. When the paper was published in 2013, it got a lot of pushback from the scientific community. The pushback was, you know, we don't see this soot and nanodiamond evidence. That was another piece of evidence. They were able to explain away the nanodiamond evidence, the soot and charcoal evidence. And also, their biggest argument was, if this really happened, you're going to get a gigantic crater. They said it's going to be 15 to 20 kilometers across, and we're talking only 11,900 years ago. There's no way the crater would not have been found by now. So the fact that we don't see any crater tells us this isn't the explanation. And so they were arguing for some other explanation for the breach that changed the flow of this Lake Agassiz water. However, then another paper came out where they said, we've actually found a platinum signature. You know, platinum is something that is quite abundant in these iron meteorites. And they said, we find this at sites around the world, and basically said, we really do think there has to be a major event. That got pushed back, where they basically said, no, we think that that platinum signature is simply this asteroid that hit in northwestern Greenland, and that explains these little iron meteorites, we said. And they said, it's a local event. It just disturbed Greenland. It didn't really disturb anything else. And it's just those two big iron meteorites that we see in the Smithsonian and the Danish National History Museum. Okay, 10 days ago, a paper got published where they said, we not only have discovered a crater big enough to explain this event, it's even bigger. And the reason why we didn't find it, it was more than 3,000 feet below ice. And so that was a big argument against the explanation. Where's the crater? And if it's that recent, there's got to be a crater. Well, they just found the crater. It's that little spot there in northwest Greenland. Here, I'll give you a blow-up. That shows it right there. And I'm going to take away some of the red shading so you can actually see the glacier underneath. This is what's called a Hiawatha ice field in northwest Greenland. And what they've also been able to determine is that this meteorite that you see here is actually part of it, but just a very, very tiny part of it. In fact, they determined that the asteroid that hit here was 1.5 kilometers in diameter. This is a really big iron meteorite collision event. And yeah, a few pieces have been found, but they said most of the meteorite is 3,000 feet below ice. They found this gigantic crater. And they said, how did they find the crater? They used what's called ice penetrating radar. They In fact, the people who actually thought that this was an explanation said, no, wait a minute, we did find this thing, and we found eight other big rocks like this that are iron meteorites. Maybe there's something underneath the Greenland ice field that we're not seeing where the rest of the meteorite will be. And so it literally took years to convince the U.S. government to allow airplanes to fly over this area with the necessary radar equipment. That literally just got funded a year ago, and when they flew over, they found the evidence they were looking for and actually sent geologists at the edge, because they actually went here where they saw some meltwater coming off of the Hiawatha Glacier, and they chemically analyzed that meltwater, and it's got all the elements that you'd expect from a giant iron meteorite collision event. And then they fly over with the aircraft, basically revealed this huge crater underneath more than 3,000 feet thickness of ice.
How much is the crater?
It's the crater is 31 kilometers across. So even bigger than what they thought the 15 to 20 would be.
That's not a picture of it, is it? Is that a, what is it, just a location?
Okay, what you're seeing there is a satellite image of northwestern Greenland. I mean, I can push this back for you. That little red dot that you see there, that's where the crater is. And this is kind of a blow-up of a satellite image showing you. That's Ellesmere Island to the left and Greenland on the right. And then a little more of a blow-up there, basically showing you how much of the crater is actually covered by the Hiawatha ice field.
Well, if this meteorite was 1.5 kilometers in diameter, and it's the mass of it is, a mile below the surface, something like that, shouldn't there be enough metal down there that they could detect the magnetic field or, from fly over something like
well,
that?
Well, this paper is basically saying no doubt that there's this giant crater there. And they were able to measure the crater and its characteristics and say there's no doubt this is done by an iron meteorite. Only a iron meteorite could develop the damage in the crater that we see. They were also able to come up with a rough date for when this happened, because what they notice is there is very little erosion evidence on the crater. They said the lack of erosion evidence tells us it has to be within the last 50,000 years. And more likely, it dates to about 12,000 years ago. So they're saying, we believe we have found what got the Younger Dryas event to happen. It was this event that caused that enormous cooling of the planet for a 1,200-year period.
Well, aren't you trying to associate this also with Lake Agassiz, an event? Are these two different things, or is this the same event?
Well, okay, I'm suggesting, you won't see this in the research papers. I'm suggesting that the two pieces of evidence are related, that this collision event has a role in changing the outlet of Lake Agassiz from the Mississippi to the St. Lawrence. We do have evidence that there was sufficient flow of cold meltwater into the North Atlantic to reverse the Gulf Stream. If we reverse the Gulf Stream, it explains the temperature data we see around the world for the Younger Dryas event. And we got an asteroid of that size hitting the Earth. We're not just talking a climate anomaly for North America. This is going to have a global impact. And there's actually papers published where they said we actually see the evidence of the Younger Dryas cooling event even in South Africa. So that's a recently published paper that came out. So the fact that we see it all around the world tells us this isn't relatively minor asteroid that people were claiming that hit. It's actually a major event. And moreover, what's also come out in the literature as a result of this announcement is it's not just these eight pieces. What we actually have discovered, if you look into the history of the Inuit peoples here in North America, they would migrate hundreds, even thousands of miles to northwest Greenland in the summertime to harvest the iron from the iron meteorites. And so apparently for thousands of years, the Inuit have been basically harvesting pieces of this. So the whole point is, it's a lot more than just these eight pieces. And they were using that to make their tools. It was all done through cold forging, but they were making very sophisticated. And keep in mind, the quality of the steel you get here is better than our most expensive stainless steel. Because this asteroid chunk is basically pure iron, cobalt, nickel, with a lot of platinum in it, silver, gold, I mean. So these Inuit basically said, we got a prize here. And you know, every year they would send a delegation of their peoples to go there and harvest chunks of the metal and bring that back to make tools. So, yes.
We have an online question.
Online question, great.
Johnny is asking why such a recent collision event such as a large meteorite didn't create a lasting disaster ecologically for global life. Wasn't the Yucatan event only slightly larger?
Well, the Yucatan event, we're talking an asteroid that's 10 kilometers in diameter. This is 1.5 kilometers in diameter. So yeah, and incidentally, they have been able to document that this event did have a huge ecological impact. As I've already mentioned, it impacted the megafauna here in North America, and to a lesser degree in Siberia as well, and had a devastating impact on the Clovis culture. So, yeah, this is not just a minor event, but there's a silver lining in all of this. And this is where I'd like to take you next. This is the typical ice age cycle. And because of this Younger Dryas event, instead of the global mean temperature jumping up to 2 to 3 degrees centigrade where we are now, it came short. And so because of how dramatic this Younger Dryas cooling event was, it prevented this part of the ice age cycle of the global mean temperature jumping up to 2 to 3 degrees centigrade above where we are now. And if you recall here in the class, I spent some time explaining to you why, if the temperature goes up 2 to 3 degrees centigrade above where we are now, we rapidly go into an ice age. It's because that much of a temperature increase will melt the polar ice cap. When you melt the polar ice cap, instead of 60% of the sunlight being reflected away to outer space, only 6% is reflected away. All that additional heat goes to transform the liquid water in the Arctic Ocean into snow that falls over Canada and Siberia. And even though Canada and Siberia are warmer, all that extra snowfall covers it with snow, which becomes ice, which cools down the whole planet. And we see that consistently throughout the entire ice age cycle. The only time it didn't happen is the ice age cycle we're in right now. And so thanks to this Younger Dryas cooling event that was ignited by this giant asteroid striking in northwestern Greenland, instead of the temperature jumping up to its typical maximum, it stopped short. Okay, what stabilized the climate? Because if I go back to this graph here, we would expect the decreasing tilt of Earth's rotation axis to cool us a lot more significantly than what you see in the past 9,500 years. Yes, there's a cooling effect, but notice we're only talking a cooling effect of less than a degree centigrade. What stopped it from cooling as rapidly as it should occur? Basically, human civilization. Once we got a stable climate, we began to upscale our agriculture. And the two biggest effects that stopped the cooling from being as dramatic as a natural cycle otherwise would have it be would be the domestication of cows, the domestication to a lesser degree of sheep and goats, and then the domestication of rice. That agricultural industry greatly increased the release of methane into the carbon dioxide, as well as methane to a large degree and carbon dioxide to a lesser degree. So instead of the climate getting cold at a very rapid rate, it cooled just at a very gentle rate. until 50 years ago, where we have this sudden burst of human technology, where now we're pumping huge amounts of carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, methane, and hydrofluorocarbons into the atmosphere. And that explains that sudden jump of temperature we see in the past 50 years and other things as well. But it's a combination of the Younger Dryas cooling event and the launch of human civilization in just the right way that stabilized our climate for the past 9,500 years. Now, were humans actually planning this? I don't think so. They had no idea. They didn't have ice cores in Greenland until just a few decades ago. This is all happening just by humans doing their normal thing. But the amazing thing is the combination of these unprecedented natural events combined with the way we humans launched our civilization gave us this incredible period of extreme climate stability, but also led to the demise of these creatures. So, well, basically the point I'm making, it's God that's controlling the natural phenomena, and it's God that's actually in control of human activity. As it says in the book of Proverbs, God controls the decisions of the kings. They think they're making decisions on their own, but he says, no, I'm the one that determines the actions that they take. And again, yes?
Hugh, is it still your position then that we are overdue for, we postponed Ice Age, and that human activity has still postponed the Ice Age that should have normally come in this time period?
It's human activity that postponed the Ice Age. One reason we know that, we've been 14,000 years now in a warm interglacial. That's never happened before. Typically, the interglacial ends after 10,000 years. We've extended it another 4,000. Some people claim we've actually, in view of the Younger Dryas, the claim is that we've extended it by 6,000 years, not just 4,000. Because if it wasn't for the Younger Dryas, it would have been even quicker that we would have been dropping into an ice age. But yeah, the alarming thing now is we're warming the planet to such a degree we could be bringing on the next ice age. But there are ways we can do to extend this period of extreme climate stability. The book I'm working on right now is basically laying out a strategy where we could sustain this period of extreme climate stability for many more centuries than just one. However, there's ultimately a day of reckoning. When finally all the ice left over from the last ice age is gone, that's going to have a dramatic impact on our agriculture. And likewise, the fertilization of the great agricultural plains is running out. There are places in the world today where we're realizing the natural fertilizer there is not adequate to sustain the agriculture, and so we've had to come in with artificial fertilizers. The problem with the artificial fertilizers, they release nitrous oxides into the atmosphere, which actually works to warm the planet up more than it should.
There's 7.5 trillion people in the world now. I didn't know that.
Yeah, we've got to feed more people. 7.5 billion, right. So the pressure on the ice left over from the last ice age is greater than it was before. So there's a limit to how long we can sustain this period of climate stability and still feed 7+ billion human beings. On the other hand, I do think we can at least extend it for another millennium, maybe even another millennium and a half. That is definitely possible.
Well, that depends upon whether we trigger the ice age or not.
Well, if we trigger the ice age, it's all over.
Yeah. And I guess the okay. So what we're saying is we continue to heat it up, and at some point we evaporate enough water so it goes up and forms snow and comes down, and that snow comes down over the high altitudes, triggering the ice age. And so, do we have an estimate of how hot we have to get to evaporate enough water to do that?
Here it's 1220.
It's 1220? Okay, we need to end. But to quickly answer your question, since 1980, half of the polar ice cap has melted away. If we melt the rest of it, that will bring on the next ice age, because that will guarantee enough snow will fall over Canada and Siberia that you're going to get an ice cap forming quickly. And as a Canadian, I would really be grieved that that would happen, because I like to vacation in Canada, and it won't be so much fun if it's covered with 3,000 or 4,000 feet of ice. So, but hey, let's close in prayer. Father in heaven, we want to thank you, Lord, for the way you've engineered the earth over these past few thousand years. Lord, our scientific community just couldn't believe that there'd be such three gigantic collision events in such recent history, but this is exactly what we need to enjoy this period of climate stability that's enabled us to have such a large population with the technology that we can discover you, discover your plan of salvation, and Lord, where people can realize their need for a Savior. And Lord, we thank you that you came here at just the right time, where transportation became global in extent rather than local in extent, where the good news of salvation through what you've done for us on the cross could be taken to all the people groups of the world. And Lord, we recognize there's a limited time to how long we can extend this period of extreme climate stability. We're grateful that you've given us the tools to be able to do that very thing. But Father, we realize that you've given us this period for one purpose, and that is to bring an uncountable number of people into a relationship with your Son, Jesus Christ. So Father, may we be just as focused on that mission as on the mission of extending this period of climate stability. And Father, I pray that those of us who are followers of Jesus Christ would really begin to be motivated to take seriously the command that you gave us, to take the good news to all the people groups of the world and to make disciples of people in all those people groups. And Lord, we thank you that you've given us all the resources that we need to finish that job in less than 10 years. Father, I pray you give us the motivation. In Jesus' name, amen.